Sarasvati Sri Srimati Swami Grace A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki Jai Raja Granta Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Gaur Pranandi All glories to the assemblies All glories to Sri Sri Gurvanga Uranga Om Ajnana Tamirandasya Ananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupakadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vancha Kalpaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyarevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadarha Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare O namo bhagavate vasudevaya O namo bhagavate vasudevaya O namo bhagavate vasudevaya Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 18, Verse Number 27. Yam loka pala kila matsara chvara Pitva yatanto pipritak samityacha Patum nashekur dvipadash chatushpada Sari shripam starnu yar atra drishyate Pum you Lokapala. The great leaders of the universe, beginning with Lord Brahma. Kila, what to speak of others? Matsara Jara, who are suffering from the fever of envy. Kitwa, leaving aside. Yatanta, endeavoring. Api, although. Pritak, separately. Samitya, combined. Cha, also. Patum, to protect. Na, not. Sheku, able. Dvipada, two-legged. Chatupada, four-legged. Sarishripam, reptiles. Stanu, not moving. Yet, whatever. Atra, within this material world. Drishyate, is visible. Translation for Prabhu Srila Prabhupada. Translation, my lord, from the great leaders of the universe, such as Lord Brahma and other demigods, down to the political leaders of this world, all are envious of your authority. Without your help, however, they can neither separately nor concertedly maintain the innumerable living entities within the universe. You are actually the only maintainer of all human beings, of animals like cows and asses, and of plants, reptiles, birds, mountains, and whatever else is visible within this material world. Purport. It is fashionable for materialistic persons to compete with the power of God. When so-called scientists try to manufacture living entities in their laboratories, their only purpose is to defy the talent and ability of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is called illusion. It exists even in the higher planetary systems, where great demigods like Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and others reside. In this world, everyone is puffed up with false prestige despite the failure of all his endeavors. When so-called philanthropists, who supposedly want to help the poor, are approached by members of the Krishna consciousness movement, they say, "You are simply wasting your time while I am feeding vast masses of starving people." Unfortunately, their meager efforts, either singly or together, do not solve anyone's problems. Sometimes so-called swamis are very eager to feed poor people, thinking them to be Dridra Narayana, the Lord's incarnations as beggars. They prefer to serve the manufacturer Dridra Narayana than the original Supreme Narayana. They say, "Don't encourage service to Lord Narayana. It is better to serve the starving people of the world." Unfortunately, such materialists, either singly or combined in the form of the United Nations, cannot fulfill their plans. The truth is that many millions of human beings, animals, birds, and trees, indeed all living entities, are maintained solely by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ego bahunam yog dadati kaman. One person, the Supreme Lord, is supplying the necessities of life for all other living entities. To challenge the authority of Narayana, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the business of asuras, demons. Yet sometimes suras or devotees are also bewildered by the illusory energy and falsely claim to be the maintainer of the entire universe. Such incidents are described in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, where Sukadeva Goswami tells how Lord Brahma and King Indra became puffed up and were eventually chastised by Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. I thought the previous verse was the verse I had to discuss, so I wasn't prepared for this one. Anyway, the quality of the first quality Krishna mentions of the asuric person in the Bhagavad Gita is pride. This is the first quality of a demon. So anyone who is suffering from pride, is a demon. Or at least, at the very least, is having some influence mood, Asura Bhavam. So this is, if anyone's doubting if how much they're a demon or not, then it can be understood by the existence of pride and to what degree. The more proud one is, the more demoniac he tends to act and behave. And of course, the less proud, the more saintly. I mean, you have no pride, then you're extremely saintly. So the effect of pride, as being discussed here, is that it does not allow one to appreciate his dependency on others, especially doesn't allow him to appreciate his dependency on the Supreme Lord. This is the basic effect of pride. So one thinks, without the Lord or without others, I can accomplish everything. And in this way, his behavior becomes increasingly absurd. Because in the beginning, one can imagine himself able to accomplish so many things alone. But then as he takes on the activity, then it becomes apparent that he is requiring so much support. Just like if one has to manage a temple, one cannot obviously manage it alone. I know, I don't know if I should say, anyway, I know in the New York temple, the leader there, one time, he's has a lot of strong control over the temple. And when devotees wouldn't follow, he would just kind of like kick them out. And then he said, I'm prepared to do everything myself. And the temple is actually huge. It's like a, I don't know how many stories, it's a 7, 8 story building. It's a huge building. And then, and deity worship and cooking and bills and so many things have to be done. And he would, and he told one time, I guess in frustration with a particular devotee, that he's prepared to do everything himself. But if you have to manage a temple, you cannot do it by yourself. You cannot even do it with a small crew of people very effectively. You need a lot of people to manage a temple. So then, if one tries to maintain a situation without recognizing his dependency on others, and ultimately his dependency on the Supreme Lord, then his activities become more and more absurd and ridiculous because he's constitutionally subordinate and requires shelter. This is the main point that the Shastras want us to understand, that we as constitutionally require shelter for our support, for our existence. So then to the degree one recognizes that, to that degree he actually surrenders to God and he becomes a devotee. And to the degree he does not acknowledge that, he becomes proud and tries to do everything himself. And so this is being mentioned here by Matsurajara. Matsurajara means here the fever of envy. Because persons are envious of the position of the Supreme Lord, then they are trying to compete with his position. That's what Prabhupada is describing here in the purport. And this is extending all the way to the Lord Brahmas and the Indras who challenge the authority of the Lord, all the way down to the materialistic persons of this world, political leaders and so on, who challenge the authority of God. They say, what do you need with God? We will provide everything. We will provide the foodstuffs. We will provide the shelter. We'll provide the clothing, we'll provide the education, etc. So what do you need with God? I think Prabhupada was noted, he told of, I think, the communist situation where the people were starving, and the communists told the people there to go pray to God to get foodstuffs. So they went and prayed to God, and no foodstuffs came because, of course, the government was hoarding all of it. And then after they weren't able to get the bread stuff from God, they came out and said, we can provide the bread stuff. You just give up this God and we will give the bread stuff. So what do you need with God? And Srila Prabhupada said, well, where are they getting it from? And very simple argument, but hard to understand when you're hungry, I guess. So the idea here is that living entities are an illusion, and they think they're not dependent on anything or anyone. Krishna, in the chapter, I think 15 of the Bhagavad Gita, he tries to describe many ways how the living entities are dependent upon him by describing how he's the fire of digestion. He's the light of the moon, which is giving life to the vegetables, otherwise they cannot grow. He's the light of the sun, which allows everything to actually grow and function in the material world. He's a source of rain, which brings up the foodstuffs and other such things. So even on the most basic level of existence is the necessity to eat. Doesn't, and so therefore Prabhupada speaking about a lot about philanthropists who provide foodstuffs for others. This is the most basic necessity of all living entities. It's called anamaya consciousness, where one has to eat in order to live. And so naturally, this becomes a major priority on the list of most conditioned souls, even devotees. Without eating, we don't know how we can function. You know, I've heard some devotees say, if I don't get, you know, certain meals of the day, then there's no question of hearing, chanting, what is the use of all these things? That influence may actually come in the mind on account of anamaya consciousness. So that's a very prominent consciousness for all conditioned souls. The most fundamental basis of existence is the necessity to eat. So Krishna, in many places in the Bhagavad Gita, describes that in order for that necessity to be fulfilled, then he is the one who has to provide for that. Where is the food stuff coming from the ground? And how does the food stuff grow out of the ground? Even if someone says, no, we are meat eaters. But in order to maintain the animals, they depend on the land. You may depend on their meat, but the animals depend on the land. So where is the food stuff out of the land coming from? Krishna says, of course, it's coming from the rain. And where does the rain come from? From the performance of yajna. So then if that isn't done, then rain doesn't come, then you don't have your food stuff. You know, you can't solve your chapati problem, as it were, without the rain, and that's coming from the Supreme Lord, who's pleased by the performance of yajna, which is mentioned in the Vedas. So how do you get the rain to come? Generally, due to the influence of the demoniac mentality, we don't like rain. I don't know, generally, because rain tends to put a dampen on the sense gratification program or the mood of enjoyment. Oftentimes, unless it's like a romance scene or something, the rain is oftentimes kind of like a damper on the spirit of enjoyment. So when it starts raining, I don't know about you, I remember growing up, and I hate the rain. I would hate getting wet with my clothes on, etc. But we don't realize how the rain is so essential for our existence. If you ask kids today, where does food come from? They'll probably tell you Dominic's or Jewel Osco or Walgreens, because there's such a disconnect between how we're actually dependent on the Supreme Lord and the way we conduct our society today. We create an illusion that we're not dependent on anyone. I have technology, I have my education, I have my Dominic's and my Walgreens, I have medicine, etc. So where is the dependency on God? Actually, in a traditional Vedic culture, was much better without the technology, without the hospitals, without the stores that you could just walk to and so on. That situation is actually much more conducive for realizing our dependent nature, and which is the idea of Vedic culture. And the modern culture, although it seems to be highly convenient, it's very destructive to the soul's understanding his dependent nature on the Supreme Lord. So although many devotees will consider this a great facility, that we have technology, we can communicate across the globe in seconds and et cetera. Actually, all these things become impediments for the soul's actual realization of God. Whereas in the Vedic culture, suppose you get sick. Nowadays, you get sick, you can just take medicine and continue to go on with your activities of sense gratification. You don't have to depend on family. You don't have to depend on friends. Just go to the store, get some NyQuil or something. Take it, take a little rest, and get up. And you can still be operative, even though you're actually quite sick. And this is considered a form of advancement. I know in one letter where one thing Srila Bhaktisiddhanta wrote called the Rules for the Mat, those who are living in the Mat. One of the rules is that one should not take too much medicine. And the reason for this is because, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta expresses, because the tendency is to continue on with your program of sense gratification even while you're sick, and that way feel yourself independent like the Supreme Lord. And this way he says that the members of the mat shouldn't even take too much medicine. Because when you're sick, okay, I'm not suggesting, all right, now from this day on we should stop taking medicines if you're sick and so on. That's not the idea. The idea is one of dependency. When you're sick, then in a traditional culture, like Vedic culture, then you would see how dependent you were. You needed your family to take care of you. They need to bring you food. They need to, you know, maybe even bathe you in certain situations. And in this way, in so many ways, you got the chance to see how I'm dependent. This creates a sense of humility. And with that humility, it makes it easier to recognize the authority of God. Whereas in a situation where you don't feel that dependent on anyone, I have my own money. I have my own house. I have my own facility. Then what do I need with anyone else? And what do I need, what to speak of anyone else, what do I need with the Supreme Lord himself, who I can't even see and so on? And that way one becomes excessively proud, and that makes it hard to recognize the authority of God. Generally, those who are deprived of material facilities, it makes it easier for them to perceive the hand of God in their life. Therefore, Queen Kunti prays like that, Jamaishraya Shruta Shribir, Edamana Mada Puman, Na Abhihartu Abhidatum Vayatama Kinchana Gocha. Queen Kunti prays in this way, that those who are Edamana Mada Puman, they're intoxicated by pride on account of their wealth, their aristocratic birth, their education, and their beauty. Then even though they may also pray to the Lord, they cannot do so feelingly. It makes it hard to do so feelingly because I have my health, I have my money, and so on. So it's just like coming to the Supreme Lord just is more of a ritualistic function. It's something good to do, but one cannot really feel himself dependent. But when all those things are taken away, it's much easier to feel yourself dependent on account of being deprived. Therefore, Krishna says when he shows his mercy, his special mercy, then he takes everything away. And then because of that, all the family members don't like you anymore. this is actually what the verse says. In other words, the relationships in the material world are generally based on material facilities. If you have material facilities, everyone loves you. And if you don't have material facilities, I love you. You know, it's a little bit less. You know, I always love you, even though I don't want to see you right now because you don't have facilities. This, if you read the Avanti Brahmana pastime in the Bhagavatam, this is exactly the story. When you have facilities, many people are attracted to you. Your intelligence is there, and you can speak very nicely. This is a type of facility, education or knowledge. You have money, you have beauty. Then people tend to flock around you. They tend to appreciate you and so on. But when all those things aren't there, then that's when it's really tested. Oftentimes, you hear couples speak in highly romantic ways. I love you. I'll be with you to the end until death do us part. And then something else does them apart. I remember a story. I don't know if this story was true, but this came in the news. This is about 3 years ago. It's kind of outrageous. That's why I'm laughing. That's why I don't know if the story was fully true. But anyway, I'll mention it because it was thought to be true at least for a day. And in the story, there was a guy and a girl, and the girl was a dentist, and her boyfriend broke up with her, and he hooked up with another girl. A classic story. So he had some tooth issue. So he went to his ex-girlfriend for her to fix the tooth issue. And then she took out all his teeth. We put him under heavy, what do you call it? Anesthesia. And then began to remove every one of his teeth. And then apparently she went to jail. I think a few days later they said the story wasn't true, if I recall. It was about 2 or 3 years ago. But it just shows you the type of psychology that's going on with individuals. When you have certain facilities, then everyone tends to appreciate you, certain opulences. Krishna has all the opulences in full, and therefore they can never be taken away from him. They're eternally a part of his swarup, his actual nature. And therefore, Krishna remains all attractive on account of his supreme opulences. The living entities are actually having borrowed plumes. That means Krishna is extending some of his opulences to living entities according to their karma. And then according to their karma, he's taking those opulences away. So when there's good karma and Krishna's extending some features of his opulences to the living entities, they become attractive, not because of their own opulences, but because of the opulences of the Lord. This is called a borrowed plume. The example given, I think, by Prabhupada is a peacock, not a peacock, a crow, who takes the feathers of a peacock and puts it on his head or on his body and thinks he becomes a peacock. Because by wearing the peacock feather, the crow becomes beautiful. But the beauty is not due to his own intrinsic beauty. Maybe some people like crows, but generally a crow is not an animal that's very much appreciated in Vedic context. But he may become looking somewhat beautiful due to the influence of the plume of the peacock. So similarly, the living entities by themselves are not so attractive. They can't attractive in the sense of being able to give shelter. They don't have opulences by which they can actually, on their own merit, instill that confidence in other living entities. They can only be able to attract other living entities when Krishna extends some of his own opulences to them due to their influence of their good karma in a materialistic sense. And that way they become attractive to other living entities in the sense of being able to, they get the idea, oh, this one can provide me shelter. Look at his knowledge. Look at his beauty. Look at his wealth, et cetera. Look at his fame. He can provide me shelter. That's actually due to the influence of the Lord's opulences and not due to the soul's merit on his own, which is due to the pride. They don't know that. So then when karma, when it happens that due to their karma, those things are taken away, then the naked truth comes out that the soul alone cannot provide any shelter for anyone. At that time, although they may have made a vow to death do us part, then they find their relationship oftentimes strained when that karma fructifies and those opulences are taken away. Then no one cares for you. And oftentimes, even sometimes we can ask ourselves this question, on what basis are we attracted to individual living entities? Like devotees, let's say in the context of devotees, what is the basis by which we find ourselves attracted to them? Is it because of the desire to render service to them or because of the opulences which they possess? And then if minus those opulences, I wouldn't care for them whatsoever. A good example is Jaya Pataka Maharaj. You know, he's of course a profound devotee in our movement. And later on he had this heavy stroke by which he was requiring so much support due to the influence of stroke, and by the prayers of devotees, he's, you know, still very much operational and traveling around the world and all these things. And what I found particularly wonderful about this particular incident in our movement was how many, so many of his disciples were rendering service to him in a very intimate sort of way. Even though perhaps some of the opulences seem to be somewhat removed now on account of the influence of the stroke by the will of God, some of the disciples, due to their service attitude, they were rendering very intimate services that would be very difficult to render for those persons who didn't have a strong service attitude towards the spiritual master. So sometimes we live in a world of romance where we think our desire to serve is very profound and we really love someone. We just want to serve them and be with them and so on. But then when their opulences are removed by the influence of God, you know, wealth, health, maybe their beauty, etc., then people lose their enthusiasm to associate or to render service, showing that maybe the mundane nature of our own consciousness, and also showing the reality that no living entity alone can give shelter, that the Supreme Lord is actually the only shelter for any living entity. So persons in this world, they try to compete with the Lord, not knowing that their strength is coming from the Supreme Lord himself. When Prahlad Maharaj was questioned by his father, where's, you know, everyone in the universe is afraid of me, but you're not afraid of me. What is the source of your power? And Prahlad Maharaj said, the source of my power is the source of your power, Vishnu. And, you know, for Hiranyakashipu, that was just like, you know, he couldn't handle that. And so he immediately wanted to kill Prahlad Maharaj for that reason. But that's the reality. Krishna is actually the source of all the opulences that are exhibited by living entities. And the source, the reason by which they become attractive to other living entities. Only when we're having great pride, we cannot appreciate that, and therefore tend to challenge God, using his own opulences to do so. So the greatness of great souls is their humility. The humility means the ability to always recognize their other dependency on the Supreme Lord, and that whatever power that they're having, they acknowledge the source of that power, and therefore they remain ever aloof from the contamination of nature that causes them to become proud of those opulences, such as the quality of humility that one always understands his position of dependency on the Lord. And so even if he has great influence, he speaks, everyone wants to hear him when he speaks. He does some action, everyone wants to follow that action, and it doesn't attract him whatsoever, because he knows it is actually the power God invested in him that allows for that influence to take place. And by acknowledging that, he remains aloof. Others who, by the dint of their devotional service, they may get some opulence also. This is called Bhakti Charangini, I think, in the language of the Madhurya Kandambini. That by the influence of devotional service, you start to develop spiritual opulences, which could include wealth, worship, fame. When you speak, everyone's just like folded palms and ready to follow your every word and so on. And one starts to think, oh, this is very nice. I see that this bhakti is real. It really works. And he starts riding the waves of bhakti. Unfortunately, there's one wave he won't be able to handle, and that's the wave of his heavy false prestige that comes from trying to do that. That wave is like a tidal wave that can't be ridden, and then it just knocks you out. So many devotees, when they're going through the process of the anartanivritti, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains in the Madhurya Kandambini, they have to go, this issue will come up. This issue where they think that they're very powerful, they're worshipable, they give money, and then you have evidence why you think this also. It's not that you're just thinking it, well, some people are quite deluded and they think it without any evidence. Without any spiritual power whatsoever, they're thinking they're already very exalted and wonderful. That happens a lot too. There's evidence for it sometimes where you say one thing, you know, one simple statement, and devotees come up to you and say, Prabhu, that helped me out so much, tremendously. My whole spiritual life became revived because of that one statement. And at first you're thinking, you know, it's all Krishna's mercy. And then another person says, like, that's you, and another one, you think, wow. Maybe I'm kind of like getting on the Acharya platform. You know, I'm ready to take up disciples and so on. You know, it is a little funny, but actually this is reality. This is actually happens all the time. Sometimes devotees just play it out in their minds without it manifesting so much externally. And sometimes it starts to play out externally after some time. To protect themselves from this, one understands by dint of deep chanting and prayer that actually this is all the options of the Supreme Lord. There's not that big of a deal. Therefore, you see devotees who really have a lot of influence like that, they just like take it so, it's not that big of a deal to them. Devotees will be glorifying them. I notice this a lot with my own spiritual master. Or people will be often glorifying him, crying, falling on the ground, this, that, and the other. And he's just like looking like very like, I'm removed. I know if one person glorifies me, then it's like hard to hold the smile in. You know, someone says, you're like something very poetic and beautiful. And to try not to smile would be very difficult, you know, to try not to show your appreciation. And with these grace souls, I seen it with Rompa Maharaj also at his Vyasa Puja. Everyone's offering these heartfelt offerings, and they're just looking very, like, you know, untouched, unmoved even. A real neophyte devotee would actually feel somewhat offended seeing the unreactive nature of such devotees because they acknowledge their dependency on God and therefore are unbewildered. I remember I asked Rompa Maharaj this question at the Vyasa Puja question and answer session. I asked Maharaj, how is it that he remains so grave when everyone's like making offerings, they're crying, they're speaking very poetically, and then the rest of us in the audience are totally moved by it, you know, we're moved to tears even often. But I see you, you're just like looking and look kind of somewhat unmoved. You know, so how is it that you're able to maintain your gravity? He gave a simple answer, and the simple answer is the essence of what I'm saying today. But it's simply a joke to take those things very seriously or to think of yourself independently of the mercy of the Supreme Lord and his opulence is coming down through Guru Parampara. So anyway, this is the idea here. I did my best. I wasn't fully prepared for this discussion. Are there any questions anyone wants to ask? Anything? Say anything.
Hare Krishna, thank you very much. You're mentioning how one feature of materialistic consciousness is one takes himself independent and doesn't need to rely on others, etc. I was thinking that as devotees, aspiring devotees, we are meant to develop strength of mind, thoughtfulness, and ultimately complete dependence on Krishna. And that can sometimes look like being neglectful of other persons just out of our sheer surrender to Krishna. You know, like, for example, Richard Maharaj abandons his duties at the kingdom, you know, so he's neglecting all of those relationships to just pursue his spiritual perfection. So, what are some other factors we can keep in mind to determine for ourselves whether we're influenced by material pride or whether we're actually like being trying to just do our service to Krishna and be surrendered, etc.?
Well, let's take the same example of Parshit Maharaj, where he is completely dependent on the Supreme Lord. And so he went to the bank of the Ganga, the fast until death. And how did that dependency on the Supreme Lord manifest itself? It manifested itself as the appearance of Shukadeva Goswami. And I think in the 19th chapter, he specifically acknowledges that unless the Supreme Lord inspired you to come here at this particular time, then how is it that I'm getting this opportunity? Certainly this is due to the Lord's being happy with the Pandavas, and because I'm following that line, so the Supreme Lord is showing me this mercy by inspiring you to come to me at this, you know, this time in my life. So the dependence on the Supreme Lord obviously is inclusive, well, let's say inclusive of things like devotional service, beginning with hearing and chanting. And to hear and chant, you require other devotees. To hear means another devotee is involved. Chanting, you can chant by yourself, but in order to be, Sankirtan is considered the superlative anga that requires devotees, etc. So in this way, when one can conceive himself as only dependent on Krishna, but how that dependence manifests in itself. Even on the material platform, this is the same point I was making from chapter 15, Bhagavad Gita. One is dependent on the Lord, but how is it manifesting itself? Okay, foodstuffs, you know, and rain. So one doesn't exactly perceive, or need not necessarily perceive Krishna's acting directly to understand that it's Krishna who he's dependent upon. He takes medicine, he still thinks, I'm dependent upon Krishna. And if the medicine is to work, if the potency in the medicine is to work, it's due to the influence of Krishna. Because Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, he's the healing, what is that? Yeah, the healing herb, is there another way to say it? Anyway. So the potency in the herb that makes it finally successful is the mercy of God, and so on. In this way, one can feel himself completely dependent on the Lord, but how it may manifest in his practical life. For those who are not aware of the devotee's consciousness, he may see it as dependent on so many other external factors. Whereas on a personal level, one knows very well what is going on. So he may go to the doctor and get medicines or get surgery or whatever. But he never forgets his dependence on the Supreme Lord. It is the Supreme Lord who allows these things to actually function. Or it is the Supreme Lord who's giving the inspiration in my heart to do take this particular direction. And in this way, a devotee always conceives of his every aspect of his existence is dependent on the Supreme Lord. Like that. And so if someone is conceiving, I'm only dependent on God, and he becomes an impersonalist as a result, that may just be due to lack of full understanding of how Krishna is manifesting his life. Sometimes sometimes when we offer prayers to the Supreme Lord, we already expect a certain type of reciprocation from the Supreme Lord. So when we pray and we don't see that type of reciprocation, we feel that the Lord has neglected us. But the Supreme Lord is independent. He may be reciprocating in another way, which we happen to not notice on account of being attached to the Supreme Lord reciprocating in this particular way. And this way, a person has his vision of how the Lord is protecting him, and so on, is very small-minded. So he might have to advance to see how the Lord is actually manifesting everywhere all the time around him. Like that, I think does that address the question? I think so. Okay.
The example of Charivantaka Swami's disciples was really wonderful. I was just wondering if you could share a few more thoughts on how one develops that kind of consciousness.
By good fortune. That's one element. Because spiritual life, the challenge of spiritual life is that we're often self-deceived. This is one of the major challenges of spiritual life. So we think that we're somewhere where we're actually not. We're often self-deceived in this way. And then Krishna brings out an authentic situation. I always like to give the example of Arjuna in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where he's like, he's very enthusiastic to fight the war, and he tells Krishna to pull his chariot in the center of the battlefield with great enthusiasm. But Krishna knows what's up. So he pulls his chariot right in front of Bhishma and Drona, his two greatest attachments. And then Arjuna immediately becomes bewildered and doesn't want to fight, etc. So Krishna has a way of authenticating our actual state of consciousness, because self-deception is so powerful. And so similarly, we think that we're so devotional, we have a deep service mood, we're ready to do anything. I remember when you hear all these wonderful stories about guru disciples relationships, so you often tend to adopt that mentality, thinking that it's so easily achieved. I remember when I first heard about Narottam Das Thakur and how he cleaned the stool of his spiritual master and so on. I was like, yeah, you know, I'm ready for that also, you know, I'm ready to die for my guru and all these things like that. And then a few years later, you having doubts about if your guru is a guru, you know, or something like that. And this happens all the time with devotees. So Krishna has a way of creating events in our life to help us authenticate our consciousness. And that is actually maybe an aspect of our good fortune, because we're self-deceived. And therefore, Krishna creates a situation to help us see that we're not really there yet and that we have to improve ourselves. Now, if someone is very sincere, they'll see that, okay, I was actually self-deceived, and I really do need to improve myself. Now I really need to be practicing in a different way. I need to shift gears in my consciousness and so on. If a person is not as sincere, then he just blames the situation, or he blames the devotee, or ultimately he blames the Supreme Lord himself. So good fortune is a real element of getting that consciousness and kind of getting the hard punches in life to help us show that our consciousness needs improvement. The situation in the material world is always a disappointing one as far as our material ego is concerned. The service, when there's a service ego, there's never a disappointing situation. That's the amazing thing about a service ego, in one sense. In the sense that the circumstances, when there's shortcomings in them, when there's sudden events that are not very favorable and so on, but a service ego, there's never really a disappointing situation. It's just Krishna's mercy manifesting. And I just need to understand that this is the will of the Lord. My favorite example, which I always give, is the example of Parikshit Maharaj being saved by the Supreme Lord in the womb of his mother in his youth, and then in his older life being allowed to be cursed by a Brahmin boy. And Prabhupada was a beautiful purport. Why? He didn't complain about that. He didn't say, well, Lord, you were there in my youth, protected me from the weapon of Ashwatthama. Why now you are not protecting me from the curse of a Brahmin boy? Rather, Parikshit Maharaj thought, oh, this is the will of the Lord, and who am I to challenge the will of God? And by such a service ego, he gained the inspiration within his heart from the Supreme Lord to go to the bank of the Ganga, and that facilitated the speaking of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is for the benefit of all of us. So with a service ego, it's really hard to be disappointed in the material world. But with a material ego, the whole material existence is actually disappointing at every step of the way. Every step of the way, material existence is disappointing. It's full of hardships. It's full of heartbreak. It's full of just disappointing situations, one after another after another. So when we're self-deceived, we think that our service ego is becoming very strong and powerful, and I really just want to serve. And then Krishna's like, fantastic. And, you know, he creates a situation. And then you find out the material ego is actually operative. And you find yourself disappointed, discouraged, despondent, not wanting to do anything, questioning Krishna consciousness, questioning the association of devotees, and questioning the Supreme Lord himself. And then if you're sincere, you recognize this is actually the influence of the material ego. And if one is insincere, one thinks it's just the circumstance or the situation where the other person is on. Ultimately, even from an objective perspective, if someone does something very wrong, you know, let's say like there's a fall down and someone, he betrays you in one sense, you know, like that. And objectively speaking, that's actually what's going on if you look at it, all objective figures. That doesn't really stop you, the individual living entity, from progressing towards his goal if that's what he really wants. So if he takes that, now mentally it does become an impediment oftentimes, and that's just due to our lack of Krishna consciousness. But if we're really sincere about the goal that we're trying to achieve, we understand, we take it in another way. Okay, Krishna inspired that living entity to play this role in my life for this particular time period for that function. And now a situation has come up, I feel somewhat betrayed and it's that. But the goal of life is not ultimately lost because of this. Things can't continue if I want to. And ultimately, it's not really his fault at all. The inspiration is coming from somewhere for him to act in this way in relationship to me. Perhaps I needed this particular test in my life for whatever reason unknown to me. And so on. And therefore, the march goes on. If he's very insincere, he just blames the individual and God, and he might go away because of that. So how to get that consciousness? We have to be fortunate enough to recognize that to what degree our service ego has actually evolved. And luckily, if we're really lucky, Krishna just provides a lot of heavy circumstances by which we get opportunity to actually improve the service attitude, as it were. We speak about service attitude as if it's something so easily achieved. Real service attitude is really achieved at higher states of devotional practice, like Ruchi, where Lord Chaitanya is praying, I only care, I only want service to the Supreme Lord. Which, and we oftentimes speak about Ruchi as if it's very high thing to attain, which it is. It's not easy to attain. But then we speak about service attitude as if it's an easy thing to attain. But actually, real service attitude is really achieved at a higher stage of consciousness called Ruchi. So it is not so easy to get that level of service. Therefore, we struggle if people aren't doing, if it's not, we struggle when it's not a utopia, for example. If everyone's not doing exactly the same thing, exactly the same service, we feel some level of agitation in the heart and so on. You know, we don't feel satisfied. You know, if I got to do it, why not you? And so on. Like this, it goes on. And so we take it, okay, I need to improve. That individual may also need to improve as well. But we're speaking about from the perspective of our own self-improvement, which is where the question is coming from. So my answer in short is that we require good fortune to recognize the extent of which we're trapped by material ego, and then the good fortune to be determined to develop ourselves Krishna consciously like that. If we're fortunate, we'll do it. And if we're not as fortunate, then it's going to be a continual life of discipline. That's the way it goes. Are there any other questions, comments you want to follow up? Anything else? Anyone wants to say?
Comment on this purport I was reading where Prabhupada mentioned specifically that in order to get free from false ego, one should worship Lord Shiva, who always meditates on Sankarshan. In other words, I believe that Sankarshan is the presiding deity of false ego. And he's worshipped by the worship of Lord Shiva. In the same place, I don't remember the exact reference, mm-hmm. He mentions to get free from mental disturbance, one should worship Anirudh, who can be worshipped by worshipping the sun, the moon planet. So there are a few statements like that where Prabhupada seems to mention the specific means of worship targeted towards that end. And I was just curious if you're familiar with that passage.
I am. I feel like this section comes in the third canto in Lord Kapila Dev's teachings. You don't remember where you're reading it from? I feel like that's where it comes. I would have to look that up. I'm not able to speak much about it now. But there are other places also where it mentions in order to overcome false prestige, one has to worship a devotee, like in the 7th canto, chapter 15, or in the Manishiksha. So, you know, I guess you can just say it's a principle of worship that helps one to overcome false ego, or you can just worship Krishna, who's the source of all these functions as well. And more important than worshiping Krishna is his devotee, which has also been given as a specific remedy for false prestige. So I'll have to look at those particular sections and we can try to make a reconciliation of the two ideas.
Sorry, I just wanted to share one.
Yeah.
It's just one could note that these two examples given to varying degrees are like fruit of aspiring devotees. It's not that we want to just become free of false ego, but we want to become fixed in our real ego, which, as you mentioned, is in relation to Krishna, worship, service, etc. And then not to just become free from mental disturbance, but to come to, you know, have our mind be animated and enlivened by the pastimes of the Lord and his qualities, etc. So,
yeah. You could say, like, that's true. But you can also say that becoming free from false ego is getting situated in your real ego, because the real ego is already existing. It's just covered.
Yeah, my point was just Prabhupada's giving this prescription, worship this one, worship that one, to become free from this thing, free from that thing. We can understand just by acting in devotional service to Krishna, these fruits are achieved, becoming free from false ego by being established in our spiritual identity, becoming free from mental disturbance by having our mind, you know, so enlivened that we lose trouble, we can't sleep at night, you know, for like these devotees, like our domestic people. So, like that.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Mm-hmm. Prabhupada ki jai.